Hello, Brooklyn, how you doing? Where you going? We cannot come to. And if I can, I'm gonna be your man. You can be my lady and have my baby and drive my car. You got me crazy. However you going, baby, you going? Just take me, cause I'm so taken. Hello, Nets fans. How you doing? This is the Russell and Fro podcast. Russell here, aka Texas, and Fro there, aka the East Coast, you know, where the Nets actually play. I am Brett the Man Bun Garofalo, alongside my brave and beautiful co-host, Carl the Talent Jackson. So many fun, exciting things to talk about tonight, so I will spare you one of my long, self-indulgent intros and get to the most anticipated moments of any good Russell and Fro episode. Carl? Speak your truth, my friend. How the hell are you?
Brett, I am doing well. I'm excited for the Nets buyout bonanza. And, you know, I think we got an outline of stuff we want to talk about in terms of, you know, some of the new faces that we've seen in terms of Blake Griffin, LaMarcus Aldridge, who had a pretty fun game today. You know, we might get into a little Alize Johnson. I don't know. We'll talk a little Nick Claxton as well. But before we dive in there, what I think I want to do to start things out is, and we did this last time at the suggestion of Brendan Lockman, our esteemed producer, emeritus, is just like, let's just do a little fan check here. Let's just check in, because Brett, I don't know if you know this about watching this Nets team, but it is fucking fun. These guys are really fun. So why don't you tell me, why don't you just give me a little observation?
Fan check. I'm ready. It is fun. It's just fun to talk about this team. It's fun to watch any game. I don't care who's playing. Two stars, one star, no star, the bench. Every game is fun to watch with this team. And I think that's because the pressure of living and dying with the moment and hoping the team turns into something that you're not really confident that it ever will be, like it's been to be a Nets fan in the past, that's all gone. We know that with everybody on the court and healthy, that it's a championship level team. And it's more about watching the little maturations and the things that might help us in the playoffs. And good Lord, is it fun. But before we get into more of these observations, I do want to give a quick, since we're talking about being Nets fans, a quick shout out to our boy, Chris Milholen, who had his tweet shown on the TNT halftime show about Kyrie Irving and the Nets. Shout out to our boy. Dude's like 19 and already published a book. So friend of the pod. Thanks, man. That's awesome.
Pretty awesome. And while we're doing Twitter shout outs, I think we would be remiss if we didn't shout out Maxime Yanou. I apologize if I'm butchering the name pronunciation there. Thank you for the encouragement to record another pod. We were talking about getting one done this week anyway, but really, really meant a ton to us to hear from you. So thanks so much. And, you know, hopefully we do all right in our usual yammering way.
Also, the Nets' two best players were not playing today, and we were up 30 points multiple times in this game. And I'm referring to the Hornets game. It's Thursday night when I'm recording this. That is just insane to me.
Yeah, weird how Bruce Brown had a big bounce back game when he's sharing the floor with, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge instead of DeAndre Jordan.
And Bruce Brown is basically a younger, faster, shorter DeAndre Jordan. So putting them on the floor together is a tough one in the modern NBA.
Absolutely.
But yeah, here's my emotional check-in as a fan. If I had to pick up the biggest thing that's always in the back of my mind, I was listening to the Duncan and Hollinger podcast, and they were going through the contenders. And I think it was Duncan made a great point about this season in particular. The playoffs could be really fun. There's eight true contenders, meaning that it's going to be a bloodbath second round and beyond in both the West and the East. But because of the nature of last season, the long pause followed by the very intense flurry finish to the regular season, long drawn out playoffs, short off season, going into another condensed season, it is very likely that injuries could play a bigger role in the playoffs than they have in the past, which could rob us from some of that excitement. And it's tough not to think about the Nets as, without any of those factors, injuries were a concern for us. So I think I spend most of my time being incredibly excited about the Nets and enjoying every single moment and pinching myself that I get to watch this team, and also trying to quell my anxiety about KD's health, the health of other players on the team, like Kyrie, who's been injury prone in the past. Hell, Nick Claxton has been injury prone and they're throwing him back in and he's playing big minutes almost out of necessity now. And just hoping that we are not one of those teams that fate decides it's not your year, you're going to get hit with the injury bug. So I think that's where I'm at as a Nets fan, trying not to think about that and really, really enjoying this team.
Jesus, Brett, you really went in another direction that I was hoping to with this segment. But no, I hear you. Definitely. You know, it's tenuous, and I think the point about appreciating sort of what we have with this team is really pertinent. You know, I think two things on my side before I get into kind of my main one, which is, you know, I knew this team would be good, and I knew that watching kind of the basketball artistry of Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and James Harden once he joined would be just like a magical experience, and it has been. But I think that, you know, a part of me sort of always felt earlier in the year like it'll never be like the 18-19 season, because that was just sort of so fun and came out of nowhere. And I still have a ton of love for that season. But this team has matched that, I think, in terms of just fun vibes, contributions from just everybody up and down the bench. I mean, how great has Tyler Johnson been? I mean, how nice was it to see Landry Shamet come back tonight and knock down some threes? I mean, today we literally saw everybody on the team play. I mean, Alize Johnson with his big game against the Jazz, he got in the game today. Reggie Perry throwing in some hooks. But just like up and down this roster, so many contributions from so many different players. And, you know, I think on the low post with Nets superfan Mina Kimes, who, by the way, well, I'll come back to that in a second. But on the low post with Mina Kimes, like, Zach did mention, which I think is very true, like, if you're going to win in the playoffs, like, you need those random contributions. Like, you need the Bruce Brown game. You need the random Joe Harris eruption. Like, and I feel like the Nets are built for that, because they have so many different players on this team, Jeff Green, and now Blake Griffin, LaMarcus Aldridge, who can kind of step up, come out of nowhere. Even DeAndre Jordan has had games like that. So it's just been really, really, really fun to watch this team come together and find their identity. So that's kind of thing number one. And then thing number two, I think just a big shout out to obviously one of the big three, but I think in a way sort of maybe the least talked about, the guy that's not being referred to as an MVP candidate, and that's Kyrie Irving. I mean, he's had such a phenomenal season, and I think, you know, given some of the weirdness surrounding his absences and things like that, like it's just flying a little bit under the radar, but I don't think it should. I mean, in addition to being just the most incredible guy to watch in the league, like, he is posting just some extraordinarily efficient numbers. I feel better. I mean, obviously, I don't mean to substitute my experience as a fan for analysis, but like, I feel better with him rising from a mid-range J, sort of regardless of what the defense is doing, than I do about just about anything else. Multiple guys finishing at the rim. So, you know, and I really felt like in the Rockets game, which was a, you know, sluggish, terrible, slow start last night, it was really exciting and happy to see him, you know, will that team back in the third quarter with his leadership, in particular, the pass to Blake Griffin for like the crazy layup, and Kyrie, you know, a little bit worried that he's going to throw his shoulder out doing an epic fist bump, but just really excited to see the emotion from him and how happy he's been. So that's been a joy to watch as well. And then my last one, which I will close on, and this is a little bit of a transition to a new topic here, but so I know we're not talking about the Kevin Durant, Michael Rapoport beef because we're beyond meat only on this podcast. But in the interest of coming clean about for having said stupid things online, I did want to go back. So any of you that follow us on Twitter, we both tweet from the Russell and Fro handle. I, Carl, tweet more than Brett does, so it's probably my fault. I did want to go back and revisit something that I said previously on February 8th. It was in a reply to Billy Reinhardt. I will retweet it tomorrow. And I said about young Nicholas Claxton, I said, I think Noah, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, I think Noah Vonleh has a better chance of playing playoff minutes than Nick on this team than Nicholas Claxton. And I said it because I went on subsequently to say, like, it's just because the injury, and because I just felt like the Claxton hype was out of control. And Brett, that was dumb. That was pretty wrong. Because Nicholas Claxton has been absolutely incredible. I would like to sign up to eat some crow here. I actually did end up going down a rabbit hole of YouTube videos about eating actual crows today. that you probably don't need to talk too much about. But I think I still approach this with a healthy dose of skepticism. You know, because I feel like everybody's like, oh, like Claxton's going to be the next Chris Bosh. And I was like, okay, let's pump the brakes, kids. But A, if that shot ever starts falling, he could be better than Chris Bosh. He's so special defensively. But B, like, I think the thing that's craziest about him is not how good he is, because I will say, like, we haven't seen the shot and he hasn't been asked to either. But like, I think there's still a ways to go to figure out what his full form is going to be. What matters a little bit more to me is like what he is right now for this team. And I legitimately think if you gave Steve Nash and Sean Marks a player skill budget and said, you know, whatever Nick Claxton's overall skill rating is, like you get to assign sort of what he's good at and not good at, what his strengths and weaknesses are. If they could have created a player that would help this team, I think they would have created Nick Claxton. It's unbelievable how perfectly he fits into everything that this team is trying to do. He is just an absolutely absurd guy in terms of switching. Absolutely absurd guy. He's absolutely absurd at, you know, guarding guards. He's incredible as a switcher on defense. He fits so well into the switching system, which is something that, you know, the Nets are much more comfortable playing than any other type of defense. If he has, you know, so that's an incredible strength. He's incredible lateral movement. You know, I'm not telling you guys anything that you don't know, but incredible lateral movement. Great. Uses his length to contest shots. And we've seen him do this, you know, primarily against bench units, but he's also done it against, you know, Damian Lillard and, you know, CJ McCollum and, you know, starters as he started closing games. If he has a weakness defensively, it's on the interior. I don't know that he could like anchor a defense as a backline guy the way that like Jared Allen could. And what I think is kind of incredible about all this together is like, I don't think that skill set is just lying around the league anywhere. You know, I feel like if you were to like, I'm almost wondering, and I'll pose this question to you, Brett, like, is there another team? So obviously, you know, Claxton has, you know, benefits in many ways from playing with James Harden and especially on the offensive end, you know, playing with the Nets. But like, is there another team who he would have helped more that, or is there another team that he would have added more value to than Brooklyn? Because I like just the degree to which he is like a perfect glove for the Nets needs is kind of blowing my mind.
The only team that I can think of is every Nets fan's favorite, Boston Celtics. They love to play small. They've had a hole at center for a long time. Their best option right now is Tristan Thompson. And if you could throw Nicholas Claxton out there with Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Marcus Smart, now Evan Fournier, imagine the defensive havoc that lineup would wreak, especially with all the switching. I mean, that would be an incredible, incredible team. And they just don't have that piece at center. And they'd have him on a rookie scale contract too. I mean, that would be formidable.
But do they switch? I've watched with the Celtics when they've played the Nets this year, but I haven't watched a ton of them overall. Like, do they switch as much as Brooklyn does?
Not as much as Brooklyn, no. But you'd have to imagine if they had Clax, how do you not?
I mean, I guess like the other hypothetical is like if the Nets were still playing like the Kenny Atkinson system this year, which there's a lot of reasons why they're not, but you know, I feel like that's part of like the problem that DeAndre's had this season. It is like trying to adjust to, you know, getting up on screens and switching everything. And Claxton just like comes in and he like, I mean, he may be their best point of, I mean, it's him or Bruce Brown as the best point of attack defender on the entire team.
I think he's better. I think he's better than Bruce because he's longer. I think he slides better too. He wants it. That's the crazy thing. What big wants to be on the perimeter? Like every other big that I see out there, it's like they're nervous and they know that they need to be able to do this to stay in the league, but they go up to the guard and if they do it well, awesome, they're relieved. Nicholas Claxton is seeking out ways to guard people on the perimeter so he can eat them up, swat their shot at the rim, or make them miss. He loves it. And that, I think that's what I love about him most. The role that he's playing, he has fully embraced it. This isn't a guy that's looking to go out there, make a point, and get a superstar contract. He legitimately loves doing the things that he's best at. And like you said, those things that he's best at are the things that the Nets sorely lacked the most. It's a match made in heaven.
Yeah, and the Nets love it too because it's just like legitimately the best option for guarding those plays. It's much better than having him sit back. So he has allowed 0.61 points per possession on isolations this year per the stats.nba.com player tracking data, which is like in the 89th percentile. It's really, really, really good.
Wow.
And he has guarded them with higher frequency than most of the other players that are sort of in his range. So he's seventh in the league. If you set the track, like he's actually second on the team to Joe Harris, but Joe Harris does it on such a small percentage of possessions and over like such a small sample, with that full tracking database. But if you set the possession threshold to 30, he's like seventh in the league. And if you bump the frequency minimum up to 10%, he's second in the league behind Larry Nance Jr. So it's like Draymond Green, Larry Nance Jr., Pascal Siakam, Malcolm Brogdon, Jamal Murray is in there somehow, and Sadiq Bey, which is another conversation for another day. But
yeah,
it's just, I mean, I keep wondering, like, okay, when's the book going to come out on him? Like, when are teams going to figure out? But I really don't think there's any other option aside from just not switching guys onto him, or maybe double switching him off to like try to run like a big or like a small pick and roll and like get him switched onto somebody else. I don't know, but it's been pretty revelatory.
Well, not only the defensive end too. I'm trying to find the stats for offensive rebounding for him, but I feel like he's really helped us in that area too. And you wouldn't think that by looking at him. Yeah, he's super athletic and he's wiry, but you'd think that he would have a tough time pushing people around. He's just grabbing the ball over people's heads or tapping it out. It always seems like he's right in the middle of a play and creating extra possessions for the Nets. And when you don't have the best defense in the league, those extra possessions really go a long way, especially to let some of our players rest too. That has been another one of the most fun things to watch.
It's very true, and I think just his length out there, like, I think it also just indicates like how much they miss having Kevin Durant too, because like they're never going to be a team that's, aside from maybe when Blake Griffin or Jeff Green are out there, that's just going to like park guys, like, or like, you know, really box out and shove guys around. But with Durant or with Claxton out there, like, they do just have the length and they're really, I think, committed to gang rebounding. Somebody was, I think it was Alex Sturm, sending around a clip of Kyrie from yesterday, just like boxing out Christian Wood, flying around the court. And they have really shown, and I think part of the defensive upgrade that they've had recently has been just a real commitment to gang rebounding. And that was another thing from that Zach Lowe, Mina Kimes podcast, where he said, you know, if Steve Nash very, very rarely gets flustered or upset during games, the times he does are when they don't get a defensive rebound. And I think they kind of understand that that's sort of like an area of potential weakness or exposure. So it's, you know, it's very important for them to be securing those rebounds. So I think, like, do you have more stuff that you want to say on Claxton, or do we want to start use that sort of rebounding to transition into the front court and sort of buyout discussion?
I'll say one more thing, and this is more of just a general offhand comment. I am so, so excited to see what Claxton looks like once Kevin Durant gets back, to watch the Harden, Kyrie, Kevin Durant, Joe Harris, Nick Claxton lineup. He will never have more freedom to do whatever the heck he wants on defense, and he will never have less attention on offense. That dude is going to be catching some tremendous lobs, tons of facials. It's going to be awesome.
Well, and I think like it is so beneficial. I mean, people talk about how much he's benefited from playing with James Harden, and he obviously has, and James Harden's incredible, but like how much easier do you think it is, like given his catch radius and given like his ability to jump and get vertical in a way that nobody else on this team really can, right? Like, I mean, Jeff Green's probably your second, I mean, aside from Durant, like Jeff Green's probably your second best lob finisher. You know, there's not a lot of margin for error throwing lobs to DeAndre Jordan. So I do think it's exciting. And I do think that like it goes to show you, given the spacing that the rest of this team provides, you know, if you have him as the single kind of non-shooter on the floor at a given time, like he can still stretch the floor in different ways. And so that is very exciting. I am excited to see him play with Durant as well.
And you got me excited about Kyrie too. So I'm just going to make one more comment about him. His instincts and his intuition to find the ball or make the right play is something that I think is incredibly understated. He's just such an intuitive player out there. And you had mentioned his rebounding from the prior game. It's like he knows where the ball is going to be and is so quick to it once he makes a decision to move. And that's really what I like about him, because he seems like he's moving slow and very under control, but he can really change speeds on a dime. And he doesn't just use that on offense to blow by people. He uses it on defense or for rebounding too, where he's waiting for the right angle and then he shoots over there and can snag the ball or steal the ball from somebody or zip and get open on offense and be in the corner or cut down the lane for a layup that nobody was expecting. And that is the thing that I think makes him watchable beyond the potential best ball handling skills in NBA history. The sudden and efficient movements and the quick movements that he makes that you don't really see from other players, because he seems to be a step ahead.
Yeah. The other thing that I've noticed with him is, and this is a little bit tangential, but like picking up some of Harden's kind of like sleight of hand and deception in the way that he's throwing his passes. And I think that's been something that I have sort of always thought of passing in terms of like, you know, your vision, your ability to see the court, your ability to put the ball where it needs to be. But watching James Harden and now sort of watching Kyrie emulated a little bit, like the ability to get a pass off by fooling the defense is pretty incredible. It reminds me of, this is a really weird, comparison, but, I remember reading, like, it must've been in a print edition of ESPN, the magazine, in like the early 2000s, about Marvin Harrison. And this is before he like, you know, killed somebody. But talking about the reason that he was the best receiver in the league wasn't because he was the fastest or the biggest. I mean, you had like Randy Moss, who's, you know, super long and has amazing hands. You had, you know, all these speed burners that were faster than him, but you know, it was like a opposing cornerback talking about him and saying, you know, the reason that he was so good was because the first five steps of whatever route he was running were the same, every single time. And I feel like that's what you see with James Harden, where he's passing in the middle of dribbles. He's speeding up, he's slowing down. The angles that his passes are coming out of are like just looking exactly like he's going about his, you know, a drive or a regular part of his routine, that it's just impossible to see them coming. And I feel like Kyrie has started to emulate that and pick that up really quickly as well, which, you know, makes sense because he's always been such a wizard with the ball. And I feel like he's been underrated as a passer, but like, I just really enjoyed seeing that. I noticed it. I mean, maybe it's been happening for longer and I just missed it, but I really noticed it starting kind of last night. In particular, just like his ability to hit passes like within the flow of what he's doing already is pretty incredible and really exciting.
Well, it makes sense. He shifted to being our shooting guard. And I don't think that was just pandering to the media and trying to show, hey, yeah, I am willing to sacrifice to be on this team. I think that he legitimately said, okay, James Harden's an incredible passer. He's a better passer than I am. He can run a more efficient offense than I can. And I'm more than happy being shooting guard. And last night he didn't have to do that. And I think I don't know if it was stepping up into a leadership role. Maybe he just missed doing it a little bit because he's been a point guard all of his life and he's been the distributor. It just seemed like he was overjoyed to be the guy that was making those passes again, and he was taking advantage of it, knowing that when Harden comes back and KD comes back, he's not going to be that guy anymore. And I think that's pretty cool, and I think that's going to allow us to really weather a lot of these off nights, because all three of those guys can be the main facilitator in offense, obviously, but they're not going to be when they're all playing together. So when we rest guys, they get to be again. And I think a lot of them are going to relish in that role and relish being the guy again and doing some of those things they don't get to do when they're all playing together.
I think that totally makes sense. And I think it's a perfect transition into what we wanted to talk about today, which is some of the buyout conversation, and in particular what we've seen from Blake Griffin and now LaMarcus Aldridge, now that we've seen him play tonight, which was a little bit of a surprise. So I want to start it out, Brett. I mean, like, have you been paying attention to sort of the overall conversation around the buyout, like the buyout market and small markets being disadvantaged and that kind of stuff?
I have been a bit, and I feel like we've had to pay more attention to it this year as Nets fans, whereas before, I mean, if we were getting anybody on the buyout market, it was the, you know, the bottom feeders or people that no other teams were going to pick up and folks that Sean Marks had to take a chance on. So now we're being used as the crux of the anti-buyout market argument. And I feel like you got to be informed as a Nets fan.
Yeah. So I've been thinking about it a lot. Like I think that the anti-buyout market, so I think what's frustrating about the entire buyout conversation, right, is you have kind of these two seemingly like opposing arguments that aren't actually directed at each other. So on the one hand, you've got like your Seth Partnows and your John Hollingers of the world who are basically saying, I think correctly, that like buyout guys generally don't tend to swing, you know, playoff series or be big deals for teams overall. There's a huge discrepancy between the name of the player that tends to get bought out and their effectiveness level on the court, which I think is very true. And so, you know, this like cautioning sort of against making a big deal about it. And I think, you know, Partnow went as far to say with the Aldridge signing, like, you know, he's like, this is a very low upside, high potential downside signing for the Nets, which I'll talk about in a second. And then sort of on, not the other side of the argument, because again, like they're not talking to each other, but just sort of like also in the ether of this conversation is like Howard Beck had a piece and Woj had a piece about like small market executives being frustrated that the buyout market exists. And, you know, here's another thing that is contributing to, you know, these coastal teams, you know, stocking up on good players and big talent. And, you know, this is another, this is totally unfair. And, you know, so I feel like, you know, you just listen to the two sides of those and clearly like there's a disconnect between them because on the one hand, you know, you're basically saying buyouts don't really matter. Don't get too excited about it. And on the other hand, you're basically saying buyouts are ruining the league, which is kind of ridiculous. I think the buyouts are ruining the league argument is like a very sort of like post-Trump world communication strategy because it's one of these things that isn't really true. It's actually quite demonstrably false. And like, if you look at like Bobby Marks has gone through and tallied up, and I think Hollinger may have too, like which teams have actually bought guys out, and Milwaukee is like by far the leader and Cleveland is like third, like over the past 15 years or something. So it's like demonstratively false, but it sort of like aligns with the way people generally feel about things. So like it gets all this play, even though it doesn't really make any sense. And I think the thing that's frustrating to me as a Nets fan is that both of those miss this really key point with the Nets, which I don't feel like people have been mentioning. What makes the Nets unique in going through this is the fact that they traded four players for James Harden earlier this season. So I think it is very rare for a contender to have three open roster spots. I think it is more rare for a contender to have, you know, like the Nets traded, Caris LeVert is, you know, pretty solidly a small forward. Torian Prince is a smaller power forward. Rodion Skoroux is a similar tweener. And Jared Allen is a starting level center. So, like, that's four front court players traded for a shooting guard on a team that already probably skewed a little bit more guard heavy in the first place. So not only do they have three open roster spots, they have, like, pretty significant holes in the front court to the point where, you know, they've been able to kind of, you know, caulk the wagon and float by playing Bruce Brown, by playing TLC, by, you know, cobbling together these four guard lineups, getting big minutes from Tyler Johnson. But like they really, you know, what I think makes the Nets unique is like, if Blake Griffin is coming here, or LaMarcus Aldridge is coming here, it's not to sit on the end of the bench and like be a wise veteran. It's like, there's actual playing time. I mean, LaMarcus Aldridge fucking started tonight. So like that's a unique situation that I think kind of the part now argument misses a little bit. Like, if you think of it in terms of value over replacement, who, like, as we've seen Blake Griffin come in, like, who is Blake Griffin really replacing in the Nets rotation? And the answer is kind of Taurean Prince. And Taurean Prince hasn't been on the team for, you know, what feels like 6 months, but it's actually like, I don't know, 6 weeks. Because they've been backfilling that role that Taurean, that was removed from this team when Taurean left by, like, you know, a few minutes from Bruce Brown, a few minutes from TLC, some extra minutes for Tyler Johnson, some extra minutes for DeAndre Jordan. So, like, him coming in as a guy that, like, there just wasn't a role for, I think it's much easier to see how he could succeed, even if he's, like, because, you know, even if he's not who he was before. And then LaMarcus coming in, you know, I think the clear and obvious fear with Aldridge coming in was, if he's going to take minutes from Claxton, it's not going to make sense. But I think you see tonight, like, if he's taking minutes from Jordan, I think that's a much more reasonable conversation. So, you know, overall, that's, like, that's kind of my thoughts. That's my sort of frustration with the general conversation. I mean, like, do you have anything that you want to add or reply to there?
Well, I mean, I think you can afford to risk that the Nets took when you know your team is going to be good enough and alluring enough that you can pick up those players in the buyout market. I can't really remember another circumstance or another scenario where a team said, screw it, we'll have these open roster spots, we'll have these gaping holes, and we know that we're going to be alluring enough that these players are going to want to come to the team. But is that a small big market conversation? The answer is no.
Yeah, well, so that's a really good point, because I didn't mention this before, and I don't mean to cut you off, but I think if you wanted to make that the competitive imbalance argument, is that with when it comes to buyouts, isn't like, oh, the Nets are getting such amazing players on the buyout market. It's the Nets were willing to go through with the James Harden trade and carry three empty roster spots, which they filled with 10-day contracts for like a huge portion of the season, because they knew the buyout market existed. And it's not necessarily about them getting like all-stars on the buyout market. It's just them being able to find replacement level players that would not have otherwise been available to them after making a midseason trade, as opposed to making the Harden trade, you know, wheezing through the playoffs because you don't have any forwards, and then realizing like, okay, we need to go out and sign some veteran minimum guys over the offseason. Like the fact that the Nets are able to address that now, like, okay, there's a competitive imbalance argument to be made there, but it's much more of a bank shot than this idea that like, oh, you know, Blake Griffin and LaMarcus Aldridge are going to set the world on fire, which LaMarcus Aldridge tonight, maybe he will, but I don't know.
Well, which this is an incredibly risky strategy, and folks, nobody is saying that. I mean, so two of the points they made on the Duncan Hollinger pod was 2016 was the year that started this conversation. I don't even remember 2016 quite frankly, but apparently it was a big year for buyout candidates, and folks freaked out because these candidates went to teams that they didn't want them to. And on the pod, Hollinger was a GM that year, and you know how. Detailed Duncan is with his analysis. Neither of them could remember a single buyout candidate from that year. That's how impactful those buyout players ended up being. Last year was also a big buyout.
Bellinelli Ilyasova year?
It might. Hey, Bellinelli made an impact.
They did. Like, those are like always the two guys that come up as like, oh, these guys were actually good.
Well, and so then they were trying to make that point of the last time somebody was good and contributed. And last year they remembered people making a big deal about out of the buyout market. And the one player that they could remember from last year that played meaningful minutes in the playoffs was Markieff Morris. And he did. I mean, he was closing finals games for the Los Angeles Lakers, but that's one person that they could remember out of the two biggest buyout years from the past 5 years. So if the Nets happens to pick up players that are going to be in crunch time or meaningfully contribute to playoff games, then we got extremely lucky. And quite frankly, I don't know if any of these players are going to meaningfully contribute to playoff games. I think from what we've seen from Blake Griffin, you would like to assume that he's going to get at least 10 minutes in a playoff game. And it's crazy to think that Blake Griffin is now our energy guy off the bench, but that's what he's become. And it is so much fun. But that is that's probably best case scenario for this, outside of slowly sunsetting DeAndre Jordan and you know, moving him to the end of the bench as an assistant coach. And you know, maybe that was the purpose behind the Stoudemire signing on the bench, right? You get used to having a big man there, you ship him off, he goes to school, and then all of a sudden DeAndre Jordan's the big guy on the bench coaching.
Well, he can already take any Shabbos days since Amari is Orthodox, but what you're saying. Yeah.
How much fun is it not to root for Torian Prince anymore?
Oh, it's delightful. Well, so
it's amazing. I love him. He's a great guy, but I'll always remember that rebounding clip. But man, it's nice.
Yeah. So, but here's a fair question, like, because I agree with your point about Blake Griffin being the energy guy, and I agree with your point about Torian Prince being extremely frustrating to root for. I guess though, like, to me, I don't disagree with Hollinger and Duncan, particularly with regards to sort of the buyout markets not breaking the league. What I do think is maybe going a little bit unspoken about with the Nets is just the guys that are being replaced aren't there right now, right? Like, I think that Blake Griffin can have an impact for this team because there is no other backup power forward on this team. I mean, I guess maybe Jeff Green could be it, but there just seems to be like less redundancy in the roles that they're being asked to play. You know, I think if you figure that LaMarcus Aldridge comes in, if you figure that the rotation stays roughly the same, where they had DeAndre Jordan kind of starting, but sort of not finishing, and you put LaMarcus Aldridge in that role, and then you've got Jeff Green kind of playing up with the first unit as, you know, the starting center sits on the bench. And then you've got Blake and Claxton in the second unit front court with Claxton then playing up with the starters to finish games. Like, that to me is a reasonable way to approach a playoff rotation and would, you know, have meaningful contributions from Blake Griffin. It would have the training wheels on him because he is playing against second units and he is, you know, coming in, like you said, to be the energy guy, which is like the most exciting thing. Like, I feel like so much of the downside of that has been talked about with potential buyout guys is like, are you going to be at risk politically of getting, you know, too many minutes? Like would Steve Nash be in a situation where, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge is this veteran player that knows where he needs to be, you know, on any given play and just sometimes struggles to get there because physically he's not as fast. You know, are you going to play him over Nick Claxton, who, you know, doesn't need to be as, like, his mental processing speed doesn't need to be as quick because his physical speed is so much better, but he might make a couple unforced errors. And then, like, are you just going to sit him the rest of the game and put yourself at a disadvantage because, you know, you trust LaMarcus more? I don't think that that's how the Nets have operated as a coaching staff necessarily. And I'm less worried about that, particularly just given that in the first game that we've seen LaMarcus Aldridge play, he replaced DeAndre Jordan in the starting lineup. I also feel like there is something to be said and something to be, like a real need for guys to just eat innings in the regular season, particularly as we, you know, this team continues to play three games a week or every other day. So the fact that, like, you saw tonight, you know, there are several possessions where they don't really need to run a ton of offense to just dump it down to LaMarcus Aldridge in the post. Kyrie can take a breather. Everybody can space the floor. You know, Joe Harris can be paying attention in case he gets a kickout pass to hit a three. But, like, otherwise, like, LaMarcus is going to go to work. They just, without Durant on the floor, they didn't really have anybody in the post threat, you know, the way that they do. I mean, well, I don't know that there's anybody in the league that's as good of a post player right now as Aldridge is, but, like, there just wasn't like a realistic option to use that area of the floor in that way. You know, you could have like Jeff Green just power dribble, shoulder to chest, like back somebody in for a hook shot, which they had done a couple times, but like, I feel like it unlocks a different dimension and it just allows them to kind of diversify what they're doing on offense.
Well, it's also what it's replacing too. Like you said, Clax has no post-up game. He brings other skills. DeAndre Jordan, I mean, you pass him the ball and he's standing there looking at the hoop, hoping that somebody comes over and takes the ball from him. That, I mean, that's his offense outside of catching lobs. It's really, really tough to watch. And it makes LaMarcus Aldridge look like he's 25 and an MVP candidate again, based on, oh, wow, we can give our big guy the ball and he can command a double team and he can confidently sink a shot if that doesn't come. And, you know, wow, he can make a good pass to somebody that that finishes. And he was already getting on the Bruce Brown train tonight, which I love too. He hit him for one of his patented floaters. And before we saw this Aldridge game, one of the points that I wanted to make on tonight's podcast was my initial reaction to the signing was I wasn't very high on it. I didn't really see how LaMarcus fit in, but I understood that we needed another body in the front court. I also felt like we had to give Marks and the coaching staff the benefit of the doubt based on how all these other moves have worked out. Shamit's starting to come into his own. Bruce Brown's been a revelation. Keeping Nick Claxton ended up being one of the best moves that they could have possibly made, and trading Jared Allen and Caris LeVert instead. Picking up Blake Griffin and watching how he could fit into this team, even though it looks like he had nothing left these past few years, making one of their sole acquisitions, Jeff Green in the offseason. And good Lord, he's been a member of some of our best lineups in our small ball center and like a quiet, most important player for this team going through the season up until now. It, with all of those moves working out and fitting in so nicely, whether that's a result of Mark's intuition or Steve Nash and the coaching staff's ability to fit different pieces around the whatever variation of the big three was playing each night, who knows? But I feel like we had to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, yeah, they're going to find a way to make LaMarcus Aldridge a very productive member of this team.
Yeah, I think that's really fair. To me, I think the other thing that's the other criticism that I have heard sort of about the buyout moves, which I understand and I kind of agree with myself, is, you know, this is a team that has been overloaded kind of on offense and really needed to, you know, add to its, you know, I guess, I don't know what you'd say, like potential defensively, not necessarily add on offense. And LaMarcus Aldridge is like a really kind of offense first type player. Blake Griffin is somebody that I think brings more to the table on offense than defense. So I hear that. And I think that that's true. I think that that weakness is still a weakness. I do think to a certain extent, like, you know, the team has shown that they are playing together better on that end of the floor. They're sort of poised to be good enough, knowing that they only need to be good enough. But I also feel like at some point you have to just find value. And I don't feel like there are any players that like, I think you can risk hurt, like, because whomever you're adding has to play and has to be one of the five guys on the floor in order to have any defensive impact in the first place. Like, you run the risk of watering down. I mean, we already see with like Bruce Brown, who I think has offensive value, or Nick Claxton, who I think has offensive value. Like, you see how the team's affecting this on offense, even with a James Harden or even with a Kyrie Irving, like, gets watered down when you put one or two guys that aren't big threats out there. So I think there's something to be said for like leaning into the strength here even more, doubling down, tripling down, you know, bringing Griffin, who can shoot threes and facilitate, bringing in Aldridge, who can pass the ball and work in the mid range as well as shoot threes. And he can to big three tonight. Like, I feel like kind of doubling down on this idea that like you can have an absolutely unguardable five out offense on the floor at all times. It's a worthwhile strategy to me, because it's not like who you were going to bring in for defensive purposes was going to make that big of an impact. And we saw that with Andre Roberson. We saw that with Iman Shumpert. Like, you know, aside from Claxton, who I do think has offensive value, it's just been really, really difficult, I think, to find somebody who's going to be good enough defensively to plug in where, you know, you're going to be okay with the hit that you're going to take on offense.
Well, I think that's fair, and that fits into modern coaching strategies too, where it's like, hey, do you want to look at a player and pick out every single weakness that he has and make sure that you focus on shoring up those weaknesses? Quite frankly, not really. Maybe you pick out one or two, but you're going to put all of your effort into making something that's subpar potentially mediocre, when you could look at somebody and say, oh, this is the one or two strengths. If they get really, really, really good at that one thing, then they're going to be a valuable piece. And I think the same goes for teams too. So for us, our strength is our offense. So let's continue to find a way to make it one of the best offenses, if not the best offense in league history. Hells yeah, let's lean into that strength And, oh, by the way, if we were looking for a guy who was going to be that floor raiser for our defense, we already have him on the team in Nick Claxton. There's not going to be any other player that we find out there that's going to make a bigger impact on the defensive system than the Nets want to run. So I do think that's a great point. I think that's probably what the Nets are doing. That's been part of our culture, right? When we brought these folks in, we haven't beaten them down like prior cultures and tried to get them to conform. A guy like D'Angelo Russell, it's more, hey, what is that guy good at? Let's put him in a position to be great, give him a little bit of freedom, and build him up for his strengths versus beating him down for his weaknesses, or try to get him to potentially be just okay at a couple of things that he really, really sucks at. And that's how I'm looking at this Nets team as a whole. Let's be great and even greater at what we're great at.
I also love it because, like, in addition to being kind of just the villains generally, I have always said, and I've said this to you, like, the path to a championship for this Nets team is in many ways, like, reminds me of, like, a bizarro world 2004 Detroit Pistons, because it's going to be the team, like obviously they're remarkably different in every way in terms of star power, in terms of offense versus defense, but, like, you're taking a path where that Pistons team was, like, one of the worst offensive teams ever to win a championship. And this Nets team, I think you're better served trying to be so good on offense that you can win with one of the worst defenses ever for a champion than you are trying to, like, borrow from the offensive side to feed the defensive side. Cause then you just end up being mediocre. And I feel like, you know, the other potential to add on to it is, like, you know, that 04 Pistons team is sort of widely cited as, like, a team that broke the league in terms of, changing hand checking rules and trying to, you know, institute new rules that led to open up offense a little bit more. Like, I wonder a little bit, is this team going to be so good offensively that, like, it's going to lead to rule changes? And maybe it's the buyout rule changes as well, from a team building perspective. But, like, you know, is it going to just change things where, they're going to try to get more balance? And I don't know, that's interesting, but I would rather try to do it that way, than, you know, try to make a token effort at balancing things out, when that's not really your strength.
Me too. I think it's been a ton of fun to lean into it. And I know that James Harden definitely appreciates it, especially when you see how all of his former teammates on the Rockets have been playing. It makes you appreciate the man so much more and why he did what he had to do. And also on that note, can we just get a quick RIP for all of Jason Kidd's old Nets records? I mean, good Lord. He spent 782 game seasons with the Nets. Harden, I think he's played 32 and a half games with the Nets, and he's already broken his 30-point 10 assist game record, the amount of triple doubles, the amount of 20-point 10 assist games. Like, this is just, and I think it's more a comment on where the league is and where modern offenses are, as much as it is a comment on Harden's greatness, and also how much fun would it be to watch Kidd with his defense in the league nowadays. But, man, like, that is so wild to see every few games. The YES Network is showing a new graphic about some other record that James Harden has broken in half a season that had stood for 20 years.
Yeah, it's patently absurd.
I will also make another comment about Blake Griffin. He has been so much fun to watch, but I will say that on nights whenever that guy misses a three, it reminds me of, I listened to a podcast with Bill Simmons and his dad a long time ago, and they were talking about Jay Crowder when he was on the Celtics. And the way that they described him was, we love having him on the team. He's an energy guy. He's hard-nosed. He doesn't back down from anybody. But good Lord, he has these nights where he'll miss one or two threes, and the way that he misses them is so ugly that you're thinking, this guy he's never going to hit a shot again. Not a little three. If he takes a mid-ranger free throw, it's just never going in again. And that's what Blake Griffin's three-point shot looks like right now. When it goes in, it's perfect. When it misses, it's one of the ugliest shots I've ever seen in my life. Like, bouncing off the side of the rim, no chance, very close to being an air ball. Lucky that it wasn't. And that almost makes him more fun to watch, because when it goes in, you get even more excited.
Yeah, I mean, as long as he gets guarded out there, I think is really all that matters. I also was joking on Twitter, like, I don't know if you're familiar with the Gordie Howe hat trick in hockey. It's like a goal. I don't know. I forget. It's like a goal, a fight, and a something else. But I feel like Great comparison, Carl. I think they need to institute one for Blake on this team, because I think it's like one made three, a charge taken, and you know, some sort of enforcer like behavior, like the other day when he got beef stew Isaiah Stewart kicked out of the Pistons game, you know, due to some extracurricular elbowing by both guys. Pretty impressive so far. And you made the point earlier, like the most impressive thing about Blake, and I think the most impressive thing about LaMarcus too, so far, or the way that the team has used LaMarcus, is like both guys just seem so bought into their specific roles. I mean, Blake Griffin is like full on, like college NCAA tournament walk on that you just want to punch in the face because he's, you know, upsetting your team and diving for every single loose ball, taking charges, like, you know, talking a big game. Like it's pretty incredible. You know, he doesn't seem to, if anything, he's too, I feel like, hesitant with the ball sometimes. Like there have been shots that I wanted him to take that he's passed up, but he's obviously getting more comfortable out there. You know, I think he has simultaneously looked sort of more rickety than I thought he was going to, but also like better and a better fit and a more positive, like I have felt like there's a more positive long-term outlook just because of how intensely he's bought into his role and how much it seems like he's committed to just full on, full energy in shorter bursts with the team, which is exactly what they needed from him.
I'm with you. I think he's been less athletic than I expected, but significantly more bought in effort-wise than I expected. And I'd almost rather prefer that, because that's what we really need him to be in that role. If he can come in and maybe be that spark plug that jumpstarts the team. And your analogy works, even hearkening back to the first outfit he wore on the Nets sidelines when he dressed like a high school senior or a college walk-on that you wanted to punch in the face. So that works very well. I don't even know what to call the shirt that he was wearing.
I think it's a cardigan.
Was it a cardigan? Okay.
Wasn't it? I don't know.
Yeah, it might have been a cardigan.
It wasn't his dope sweater that Steve Nash is his jumper.
His jumper. But I will say, I think the Gordie Howe, Blake Griffin's version of the Gordie Howe, is dunking once a season, participating in a Comedy Central roast, and selling three Kias.
That sounds about right. I think especially, I like that you have to get three Kias in addition to the three things.
It's important. What equally important, though, who the heck are we picking up for this final roster spot? That's what I want to know. Who the heck are we picking up?
Gordie Howe hat trick is a goal, an assist, and a fight.
So, got it. Okay.
Well, you know, if talking about other buyout options, the name sort of mentioned or thought about were Otto Porter, although it seems like he will not be bought out by Orlando. Avery
more like
Bradley,
Notto.
Another more like Notto, Notto Porter.
Yeah, more like Notto Porter,
more like Vanilla Porter. Avery Bradley was a possibility, I suppose. Although I don't know, I haven't heard anything that the Rockets are like wanting to buy him out.
I just said that earlier because I want him on the team. I think he played well last night. He looked good. Yeah. Had some left.
I mean, it does absolutely seem like they were keeping that spot warm for Brooklyn resident JJ Redick, who had some pretty candid comments about our former assistant GM Trajan Langdon and David Griffin on his podcast. Yikes. So not real happy to be going to Dallas, it seems like. The best part was how like very just straightforward he was, like, I don't know, like as if he was telling me something I didn't know. He's like, Dallas is actually farther from New York than Louisiana. Like, thank you for your future geography lesson. What do we got?
Sorry
there?
About that.
I think it's going to be Alize Johnson, man. I don't think we need to go any further than that. Have you seen the video of him like singing in his like Cat in the Hat outfit?
I have not. That sounds.
I will be sending that to you immediately upon conclusion of recording this.
Yeah, I almost feel like we should pause the podcast, and I should watch that. So I like what you're saying. I love Alize Johnson, and this might seal it for me. That being said, I think that we should take it in a completely opposite direction. I think that we should pick up somebody that we just want to get a ring. We want to give this guy a ring. Who would be the most fun to give a ring to? Is it Jamal Crawford? Do we go all the way back to what we feared was going to be a key contributor for us this season? Do we throw Isaiah Thomas in there? Vince Carter? Number 15, New Jersey Nets. Do we pick T-Mac up? Do we get T-Mac his ring, Carl? Just throw somebody in there.
Somebody had a Vince Carter to the Nets April Fools today, and that was pretty awesome.
I mean, Joe Johnson, he can play 1 minute.
Joe Johnson is Josh Boone, playing with Josh Boone on the U.S. Olympic qualifying team.
Like, come on, give us an old regime net just to complete the cycle. I feel like if we want to go full villain, that's probably the best way to do it.
That would be pretty good. It would be a nice flex to just be like, you know, here is somebody that we absolutely will not play. But I'm giving it to Alize, man. I think he deserves a spot. He looked all right in garbage time tonight. Look fantastic against Utah. Like, and I think he's the type of guy that like we would potentially need, you know?
He's like, he's like a better version of Robinson or Shumpert at this point, where he still can't shoot, but he's younger, he's more spry, and he brings more defensively.
Well, and I feel like, you know, they now have like a super loaded front court, but like everybody is over, like, I mean, well, they're not over anything, but they're all like super washed. So I don't mind having like a set of young legs on the bench. I say they're over. How awesome, also, just on a tangent, is it that with LaMarcus Aldridge, the Nets now have a player that's older than us?
It is. Well, I mean, you know, that's one of the reasons why I was adamantly opposed to him coming to the Nets. And I'm sure that will be my version of eating crow. We'll have to tweet out an audio clip of me saying no way, no how. If he continues to play like he did after not playing for months, maybe plural, and coming in and throwing up 9 points, hitting turnaround fadeaways, looking spry, running up and down the court, it might be eating those words pretty quick. I'll be Googling crow right alongside you.
Yeah. Apparently it's a dark meat. Which, you know, doesn't shock me.
The other white meat.
I'm looking for like wordplay stuff, and I just end up on these like, you know, rednecks and like the full, like, you know, like the camo that like looks like, you know, just like is just somebody took a photograph of a bunch of leaves, like wearing that kind of shit, just, you know, and they're reflective Oakleys cooking up some crow on a cinder block fire. But why don't we round this out with any moves that the competition made at the trade deadline that strike fear in your heart? We've got Home Depot and Trevor Ariza going to the Heat. We've got George Hill taking his pregame dumps to South Philly. Andre Drummond's breaking his pinky nail with the Lakers. The Clippers signing DeMarcus Cousins, which is very sad. The Nuggets, Aaron Gordon. I mean, I don't know how the Nuggets is a deeper cut, but Aaron Gordon, JaVale for some reason there. The Raptors kept Kyle Lowry and sort of terrify me in a first round series. The Bulls got Vucevic. 3 more games against Vucevic. Brett, what are your thoughts?
I'm going to give you my quick hitting thoughts on this, and then I actually have some questions for you on this. I think this would be a fun thought exercise. But let's look at the Heat and Home Depot. The three people that scare me on that team are Bam, Jimmy, and Spo. And I think you could put any players around them. I love that they have Depot. I think that's great. I think we still beat them in a series. 76ers, George Hill. I love George Hill. I think he gives them something defensively at the guard position they didn't have previously. Does it swing the title? No. Doesn't change how I feel about them. They're a great team. They're a threat. Lakers, Andre Drummond. I think that's going to be fun to watch, quite frankly. I think it's the ultimate test for LeBron. Can he make an efficient offensive player out of Andre Drummond? If he can do that, he is the ultimate chemist, the ultimate team chemist. One of the most inefficient.
This is like, sorry, finish.
No, I was just like, this is, he's just been one of the most inefficient players in the league. And, you know, it's like, yeah, maybe it's because he's been on some not so great teams, but I think he's one of those guys that thinks the more that I dribble, the more I'm going to get paid.
This is like fully one of those like 90s rom-coms where like the guy, like, you know, or I guess like the flip version of like She's All That. And I guess Andre Drummond is like the Rachel Lee Cook role. I just imagine him walking down the stairs in like a red dress while Sixpence None the Richer plays.
There he goes. All right, so the Clippers.
There he goes again. Dribbling through the lane, and he just turned it over. He was going 1-on-4.
So miss threes. We'll cut that part. The Clippers. These guys
will
absolutely
not.
Yeah, we will not. The Clippers absolutely terrify me. DeMarcus Cousins isn't going to play. Don't really care about that move. The Nuggets, they are going to be so much fun to watch with Aaron Gordon and JaVale. I love them. They're the team that I'm rooting for to come out of the West, and I'm hoping that they're the team that comes out. Raptors, Kyle Wren, personal favorite. I think that this ending with these the Raptors and the Bulls on this list brings me to the question that I want to explore with you. I want to talk a little bit about seeding. And we don't necessarily need to talk about where the Nets are going to finish, who they might play, but let's talk about some of these potential first-round matchups, the Raptors and the Bulls and the Heat being three of those. Who would you say you're most scared to play as a potential Nets first-round matchup? And it, like, if we're looking at it, I think the realistic teams are Knicks, Pacers, Raptors, Bulls, Celtics, Hawks, Heat, Hornets.
I'm scared of everybody, but
that's me too.
So you're saying Raptors, Bulls, Heat, Hawks were my four teams to choose from.
I that's the problem with the play-in game. It's keeping a lot of these teams in play in terms of who we can match up with. So I think there's legitimately seven teams that the Nets could match up with in the first round. So you're looking at Knicks, you're looking at Pacers, Hornets, and I'm saying Hornets, I know that they're in the four slot right now. Without LaMelo, they could drop pretty quickly, and they've got some teams behind them that are much better than them. Heat, Hawks, so the Triple H there, Hornets, Heat, Hawks, Celtics, Bulls, Raptors.
So I think that Toronto kind of scares me the most. Well, sorry, were the Heat in that group?
Yeah, they were. The Heat were in that group.
Okay.
Because they could be the eighth seed.
The Heat 100% scare me the most, and it's not close.
Me too.
They're in a tier of their own because I just think that they're better than that. I think they've struggled this year with a ton of COVID absences. I don't think that the Heat are as good as they were last season. I don't think they belong in like a tier with the Nets, Sixers, or Bucks, but I think that they're very much the next best team in the league or the next scariest team in the league. So if they were to end up in a first round series, that would be shitty. I sort of don't think that will happen. I think they will kind of separate themselves over the rest of the season. But like, not only were they the team that scared me the most before the trade deadline, they also made, I think, some fairly significant improvements with adding Victor Oladipo and Trevor Ariza. So they are number one for sure. The scariest. The Raptors also scare me just because I feel like they've got Nick Nurse is really, really good. If they're, you know, I don't think this offense is necessarily guardable per se, but if there is a coach that could throw a bunch of junk at them and flummox them, and also has like an absolute army of stormtrooper defenders at his disposal, it would be Toronto. I think, you know, Lowry, like they can just do weird stuff. Like, you know, can they get Kyle Lowry isolated in the post against Kyrie a bunch? Can they be long enough and bother the Nets? Like, yeah, I could see them stealing a couple games. So that team worries me a little bit. The new look Bulls, I'm not too scared of them. Vooch is a certified Nets killer. I'm hoping that with kind of Claxton or Griffin or Aldridge, like the ability to kind of play small, you know, they can mitigate that somewhat. I have a ton of respect for Zach LaVine as a scorer, but, you know, I feel like that becomes a track meet. The Hawks, I think, same thing. Like, you know, they scare me in the sense that, like, they're one of the only offenses in the league that can keep up with us. And so that I think can get them some sort of unearned confidence in a series, but I feel like the Nets would be able to put them away. And that's sort of been the way that those games have gone, for most of the season. So that's that. Boston and Indiana kind of like scare me less, I think, just because they're somewhat known quantity. I mean, I guess Indiana getting, if TJ Warren comes back, if LeVert gets hot, like there's some revenge.
Warren's out for the season there. Unfortunately.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that scares me. So yeah, they just scare me a little bit less. DeAndre also defended kind of well against them once. So, you know, I feel like
that was his best game. I think you're right. I think that was his best game of the season.
Yeah. But then he had a really bad game, in Indiana, like when Harden dropped 40. So, you know, but I guess my point was with Sabonis being sort of a traditional post-up threat, I think, you know, whether it's DeAndre or Aldridge or somebody like having a little bit more utility inside, like I don't think they hurt the Nets the way that sort of like the teams that generally seem to have beguiled the Nets are teams that are young and, I mean, bad, but like generally just like better athletes than them. Like even like the Timberwolves, you know, obviously the Nets won that game, but just the way that like Anthony Edwards was just running amok, getting all those rebounds, like that.
All those turnovers too, he was forcing. That was the crazy part. They really got up in our grill. And I think that's probably why the Clippers scare me so much, because they have so many players that can do that.
Yeah, except that like I feel like we handled them pretty well in both matchups.
We right? did. Like,
the first matchup was one of the best games the Nets have played all year. The game at Barclays, but the game at LA like was kind of a snooze fest. I mean, I guess George was on a minutes restriction, so that wouldn't necessarily happen. Pat Beverly could injure anybody at any given moment, so that's a bit of a loose.
That is well, bit that of is a wild worrisome. Card there. Yeah,
yeah, I just feel like I was thinking we'd do a whole podcast on seeding next time, but
we should.
There are just some weird possibilities of teams getting underseeded. And frankly, Brett, like the Knicks series doesn't feel great to me either.
No, there's no pressure for the Knicks going into that series. All the pressure's on the Nets. Everybody's going to be expecting them to sweep. They're going to be pressing for a sweep. It could be one of those where you're going into game five tied 2-2 and then we win the next two games by 25.
Yeah, but I mean, like, just Tibbs is going to have those guys prepared, and they're just weird matchup wise. I think I fear that series actually a lot less now that there's that Griffin and Aldridge are on the team, just because like we just needed some goons. But Tibbs is going to make you play. Like the other thing is just like which first round series sets you up to struggle in the second round, because you know. Even if it's like a 6-game series, like you said, like it's going to take a lot out of you.
Well, that I could talk for a while about that, but I think we should talk about that next time. This is almost like one of those stingers at the end of a Marvel movie where they, where they throw out like Captain America getting one of the Infinity Stones or something like that. And you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Oh, Bucky's still alive. What?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So next time, seeding.
Cool. Sounds good. Brett, do you want to tell, do you have anything else that you want to add?
Is there anything else that I wanted to throw in here before we wrap up the old podcast? No, just shout out to Landry Shamet having a really good, competent game tonight. I think having a couple games off, getting a chance to get his mind right was really good for him. And the fact that the Nets clearly gave him a long time to recover. I think we're going to see a real fun stretch from Shamet coming up, and he's going to be key for us. He'll be the Redick that we never got.
Yeah, which is good because I think, you know, Joe Harris was 3 of 9 tonight. He could probably benefit from a night off.
Yeah, I think that he could. I feel like he's played every game, and even if he hasn't.
I think he has. I don't think he's missed a game in like 2 years. So, you know, probably wouldn't be the worst thing. He played like 4 minutes in that Utah game, but he did play. Probably wouldn't be the worst thing to get him a little bit of rest.
Please sit Joe.
Joe again. You did it once in 2018.
It's time to end the podcast. Oh man. Well, as always, guys, this has been a ton of fun. You can find us on Twitter at Russell and Fro. You can listen to the Russell and Fro podcast pretty much anywhere that you listen to your podcast. Google Podcasts, Breaker, Stitcher, Spotify. I'm blanking on any other podcast mediums that are out there. But if you find them, we're probably on there, which is pretty awesome to say. And we really enjoyed this. Pocket Cast.
Bye.
With hard knocks, better than Berkeley. They said you murked me by the time I was 21. That shit disturbed me, but you never hurt me. Hello, Brooklyn. If we had a daughter, guess what I'ma call her? Brooklyn Carter. When I left you for Virginia, they didn't offend you, cause you know I only stepped out to get dinner. Hello, Brooklyn.
How you doing? Where you going? Can I come shoot? I can't. I'ma be your buddy, be my lady, and have my baby. You got my calls, you got me crazy. Whatever you throw me, baby, girl, just take it. Cause I'm so taken, if you take it. I'm just saying, baby, I'm just saying.
That's our back.